You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
My friends, greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our first hour of Friday. It means brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with you. And with us, sanders.senate.gov, of course, his website. Bernie, welcome.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Happy Friday to you. There's a lot going on. The jobs report just came out. The right-wingers are foaming at the mouth about it. The Democrats, I'm not sure what to do. I'm curious your thoughts on these things.
Well, we gained about 115,000 jobs in the last quarter, and that is in the last month, and that clearly is not anywhere near where we want to be. The truth of the matter is that real unemployment is not at 8.1%, as the official statistics indicate. It's really closer to 15% if you count those people who have given up looking for work and those people who are working part-time. And where we're at right now, Tom, is a remarkable moment in American history. And if we don't get our act together as a nation, if working people do not come together and demand justice from their government, I wonder if there will be a middle class left in this country to leave to our kids and our grandchildren. As you know, what we have seen in recent years is the growth of a real strong right-wing movement. And these guys now control one of the major political parties in our country, the Republican Party. And what I want everybody to understand is that the debate in Washington now is not whether you put more money or less money in education or in health care. You have now a significant number of Republicans in Congress who really want to move this country back into the 1920s. They want to undo every major piece of legislation that was written to help middle class and working class people, to help the elderly and the sick. So you got guys way up there in the Republican Party. They don't just want to cut Medicare and Medicaid. They believe that these health care programs, which help millions and millions of seniors and lower income people, they believe they're unconstitutional. And they don't just want to cut back on Social Security, which has been an enormously successful program, which today has a $2.7 trillion surplus, can pay out every benefit for the next 22 years. Some of these guys want to eliminate it completely because they do not believe the government should be in the business of providing retirement security to the elderly or the disabled or widows and orphans. And meanwhile, as a result of tax policy fought for by right-wing Republicans, supported by their billionaire friends, but also gone along with far too often by Democrats, we are now in a situation which is really quite incredible, where not only do we have the most unequal distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth, we're looking at a situation now which is worse in terms of inequality than any time since the 1920s. You got the top 1% earning more income than the bottom 50%. You have the wealthiest 400 people in this country owning more wealth than the bottom half of America, 150 million people. And the latest statistics that we have seen about income inequality showed us that in 2010, we had 93% of all new income went to the top 1%. Can you believe that?
Yeah, I
and
do.
What that really means, Tom, is that it doesn't matter what kind of economic growth you have, really. Because what difference does it have if you have 2% GDP growth or 4% or 6% if almost all of the new income goes to the top 1%? And then on top of all of that, with this disastrous Citizens United decision, these billionaires are not just sitting on their money. What they are doing is plowing their money into the political process, and I think you've just seen the beginning of it. You're going to see a lot more to come. Because Citizens United said that Bank of America and Wall Street and ExxonMobil, they're just little old people like you and me, and they have First Amendment rights to spend as much money as they want in the political process, and they are certainly doing that and going to do more of it. So they're going to control not only the economy, but they're going to control increasingly the political process, all of which suggests that we have got to stand up and fight back like we never have before if we are concerned about the future for our kids and our grandchildren and preventing this country from becoming an oligarchy run by a handful of giant corporations and wealthy people, because that's where we're headed. But the truth is, you know, we can create the millions of jobs we desperately need. We know how to do that. If you invest in the infrastructure, everybody, I know in Vermont, all over this country, roads are falling apart, bridges are falling apart, water systems, wastewater plants need our rail system compared to Europe and China way behind. We need to pour billions and billions of dollars in rebuilding our infrastructure, including broadband, cell phone service. When you do that, you make the country more productive and you create millions of jobs. And we need to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel, which is causing global warming with all of the impact that that is having. And when you do that and you put money into weatherization so that homeowners are not wasting significant sums of money on heating their homes, put money into wind, solar, geothermal, biomass, you're going to create American jobs. You change trade policies so that corporations are not investing in China but investing in America. We know how to create the jobs that we need to rebuild the middle class. And it's a question of millions of people demanding that Congress act, that we elect the right people to do that, and then we got some future here. But if we don't do that, I worry very much about what happens to our kids and grandchildren.
In fact, this was my daily take. My lengthy rant yesterday was that the Republican Party should no longer even be considered a political party, a legitimate political party, because it's basically simply become the arm of corporate America.
Well, more than that, it's really, its ideology, quite honestly, is fringe. If they did not have billions of dollars behind them in terms of the wealthiest people in this country and corporate America, people would be laughing at them. I mean, if they didn't have Rush Limbaugh and they didn't have that whole right-wing media echo chamber behind them, if they didn't have the Wall Street Journal behind them. Here you have a party which is telling us that they think Obama has not done enough on the economy. Well, I don't think he's done enough, but certainly he's done a hell of a lot better than what Bush did. We think that 115,000 jobs we created this month is not enough. It's not. But you know what? It's a lot better than the 700,000 jobs we were losing at the end of the Bush presidency. It's a lot better than the 500,000 private sector jobs that Bush lost over an eight-year period. Can you believe that?
Yeah.
An eight-year period. It's a lot better than the tens of thousands of factories that were shut down during the Bush era. So the idea that the Republicans are advocating that we should go back to trickle-down economics, even more tax breaks for the rich, even more loopholes for large corporations, even more deregulation after deregulation got us to where we are today in terms of Wall Street. Yeah, we deregulated Wall Street, and they showed us what they were about, which is a bunch of crooks destroying the economy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the idea that these guys and Romney want to take us back to the Bush era is incomprehensible. But what we have got to do is put as much pressure as we can on Obama and Democrats in Congress to move this country forward in a progressive agenda. And the last point that I would make, as soon as I get back, there are going to be a lot of discussions about deficit reduction. And I hope we all, as a nation, working families, stand together and say, no, given the fact that this deficit was caused by two unpaid wars, tax breaks for the rich, and the Wall Street recession, that we are not going to balance the budget on the backs of the elderly, the children, the sick, and the poor. That's not what we're going to do. We are going to ask the wealthiest people in this country, corporations that are now paying sometimes nothing in taxes, to start paying their fair share of taxes. And we're going to take a hard look at military spending. There are ways to deal with deficit reduction without decimating some of the most vulnerable people in this country.
So well said. We'll be right back with Senator Bernie Sanders. Brunch with Bernie.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Your calls for Senator Sanders are next here on the Tom Hartman Program. And be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can join, you can sign up for his newsletter. Goodbye.
He's everything you want. He's everything you need.
Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. It's the Tom Hartman Program. And it's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. And Jonathan in New York City, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, it's
I think we've lost Jonathan.
Yeah.
Let's try Bill in Prescott, Arizona. Bill, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello. Howdy, Tim.
Hello, Bill.
Pardon me?
You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, thank you very much. All I want to say is I grew up in Chicago, same age as you, Tom. Nobody talks about unions putting you through school during the day you work for them, take classes at night, and even when I got out of service, and then you were in a journeyman, and you made good money. And then there was a program called CETA, and they would train you. I took it for a year for cooking, and then I went on for a career in that.
Yeah.
Why aren't there any programs like that?
Well, that's a good point, Bill. Youth unemployment for kids who have not graduated high school is completely off the wall. And our economic response to that is to put many of these kids in jail after they end up destroying their lives and they get into drugs and everything else, rather than finding them gainful employment. So job training for the jobs that are out there, we need good plumbers and we need good automobile mechanics and we need good cooks. There's a lot of, we need good construction workers. And the unions can play a good role in training of those workers, and government can do a good job as well. I remember the CETA program. But clearly the government is going to have to be a lot more aggressive in job training for real jobs, and also through rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure, transforming our energy system, creating millions and millions of good-paying jobs in this country. There is more than enough work to be done. The idea that in this day and age we are laying off teachers, we are laying off child care workers, where we need to significantly increase the number of child care workers that we have, the number of teachers that we have, make college education affordable, put people to work educating our kids. So there are all kinds of opportunities that we have to create meaningful and important jobs in this country. And that makes a lot more sense to me than giving tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires and large corporations.
Ben in Colchester, Vermont, listening to WDEV. Ben, you're on the air with your Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. How are you?
Good.
I'd like to ask you about, I'd like to say I think that we in order to check the unwarranted power that the billionaires have, wouldn't it make sense to tax these billionaires, their net worth, their wealth versus their income?
Well, that's an interesting concept, Ben, which people have talked about. At this point, at least, what I would be very happy about is if we, in fact, had a progressive income tax in this country. Tom, you and I have talked about what during the Eisenhower era, for the top dollar, and people have to understand this is a marginal tax rate,
right?
Meaning at the top dollar that you make if you're a multimillionaire. During Eisenhower was what, at 90%?
91%. Yeah.
At 91%. And those were the years where actually the economy was growing and was quite strong.
That's right.
So what I would say to Ben from Colchester is that for a start right now, the idea of a wealth tax is an interesting idea. It's something we have thought about. But for the moment at least, what we certainly want to do is make sure that we do not extend Bush's tax breaks for the very rich. We want to make sure that we have an estate tax, which impacts only the top 0.3%, which is progressive, not diminished. We want to make sure that we do away with the incredible, incredible amount of loopholes that large corporations enjoy. Something like 1 out of 4 large corporations pays nothing in federal income tax. Many others that make billions sometimes get away in a given year with paying nothing. So I think there's enough to be done within the existing framework of tax law that we can move aggressively to raise a substantial sum of money, help us with the deficit, help us fund the job creation that we need, help us take care of the most vulnerable people in this country.
Dwayne in Ohio, watching on Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. I want to thank you for what you're doing. I really appreciate it. And we want you to keep the ball rolling. One of the things I wanted to ask you about was, have you heard of, has anyone ever talked to you about a such thing as maximum wage?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, and those are the things that, I mean, you know, since we have minimum wage, why can't we have maximum wage? I mean, you know, if you're making all of this money, but you can't look out for the people who are making this money for you, I mean, you know, we have a problem there. I mean, you know, there must be something that we could do as a nation, because right now it seems like we've let the corporations take over from us. I've had some friends from...
Dwayne, we just have a minute for Bernie to answer your question. I'm sorry.
Well, let me pick up on Dwayne's point. Yeah. It's a good point. What Dwayne is talking about is the need to address the incredible inequality in America. And I mentioned earlier the last statistics we have between 2009 and 2010, 93% of all new income went to the top 1%, which is why the middle class continues to collapse, poverty increases. What I would say to you, Dwayne, actually refers to the question we just had a moment ago from the fellow from Vermont. And that is, if you have an extremely progressive income tax, in a certain sense, you're talking about a maximum income. More complicated than that, because people can make money outside of their quote-unquote income. But at the moment, at least, if we developed a culture, it's not only law. You know, I remember talking to the ambassador of Finland. Maybe we'll pick this up.
Sure.
After the break.
Let's pick this up on the other side of the break. We're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman program. Senator Sanders has a great newsletter, the Bernie Buzz, you can subscribe to over at sanders.senate.gov. He also is sponsoring a constitutional amendment to roll back Citizens United. You can sign up for that over at sanders.senate.gov.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And, of course, you can drop by tomhartman.com and drop into our free live chat room and say hi to some of the finest minds on earth, create your own blogs, participate in our message board, all kinds of cool stuff. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with you. Bernie, you wanted to finish a thought from the previous segment?
It's important in terms of dealing with the growing wealth and income inequality in this country, which is worse than it has been at any time since the 1920s. We really have also got to change the culture in this country. I remember talking to the ambassador from Finland, I believe it was, who said, yeah, of course we have rich people in Finland. And yeah, we have poor people. But for rich people, they understand that they're in that country, they understand they're living in a country. They're living in a society. And there is a limit to how much people feel that they should have. The idea that in this country people can be making billions and billions and not care, that we have the highest rate of childhood poverty in the industrialized world, that kids can't afford to go to college, that working class families can't provide decent daycare for their kids, that they don't really care, that they're living in their own world. In many other cultures, that just doesn't exist. Yeah, you got rich people, but there are limits. There are limits to their wealth.
Al in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Al, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Al? You got Al potted up there, Paul? Okay. All right. Well, Al is gone. Nelson in Northumberland, Pennsylvania, watching Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Hartman, and good afternoon, Senator Senator Sanders.
Hi.
My question to you is, do you think it's fair that the Stand Your Ground law should be repealed because of what Zimmerman did? Because if you've read the Stand Your Ground law, nowhere does it state that any person has a right to pursue another person and then shoot them.
Bernie?
Help me out with that question, Tom.
I think he's... my understanding is he was asking if you thought that repealing these Stand Your Ground laws was a good idea.
Well, I've got a problem. Yeah. I think that these laws... you know, you got a lot of unstable people in this country, and we have... Everyone recognizes that self-defense is part of our legal heritage. Anyone attacks you, you have the right to respond. But I think that these laws, just especially with, you know, some unstable people, somebody looks at you with the wrong way or says something, you can pull out a gun and blow them away. So I do have concerns about those laws.
Stephen, in Fairfax, Virginia, it says VI. That's got to be Virginia, though. It means VA. Stephen?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, year on year.
Bill Clinton spent $500 million a day. George Bush spent $1.5 billion a day. And Barack Obama is spending $3.5 billion a day. The wealth doesn't seem to be redistributed properly. In other words, if you're on the 60 million people at the 20th percentile, you should be getting $50 a day. If you're a working American, 135 million working Americans, you should be getting $20 a day. But instead, we're getting respectively $6 a day and a dollar a day. Where the heck's the rest of the money going?
Tom, help me with that one. I'm not quite sure about it.
I'm his numbers are not making sense to me unless they're just...
When we talk about billions. I mean, what I would say to Steve, if he's talking about income and wealth inequality, almost all of the new income being created in America is going to the top 1%. The last statistics we have, that's 93%. In terms of median family income, we know that in the last 10 years, for the average American family, median family has gone down by over $3,000. We know that poverty is increasing. So I'm not sure the point that Steve was making, but in America today, what we do know is the people on the bottom are getting shafted, working families are getting shafted, and people on top doing phenomenally well.
Yeah. Mike in Osco, Illinois, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Senator Sanders, thank you for being the voice of those of us that don't have one, and for letting me know that we're not alone out here. For the longest time, I really just shook my head at what was happening. The middle class in this country was so strong when I came home from Vietnam. I'm in my 60s now, and probably economically have lost ground, but have had the good fortune to have had a job all these years. I applaud you for everything both of you do for carrying this message. And I sometimes folks don't agree with me, but I honestly feel that it's treasonous what the rich are doing to this country and what they've done to the middle class. And again, thank you so much for all you do.
Well, Mike, thank you very much for your comments. And let me just, say this. I think what is really distressing is when you think about American history, look, there have always been rich, there have always been poor, there have always been conflicts between capital and labor. But I think what's happening right now is really, as Mike indicates, kind of unprecedented. You have large corporations whose wealth essentially was created by their workers, people who made them great, and by customers in the United States. And what these large corporations are saying, oh, thank you very, very much for making us into great corporations, but now we don't really need you anymore. We're going to take the jobs to China. We're going to hide our money offshore. We're going to lower wages and health care benefits for workers and retirees. And that is just, I don't know if I want to use the word treason here, but that is just really almost spitting in the face of the average American, the workers who made them great, the people who bought their products, and this nation. And our job right now, I think, is to tell these huge corporations that if they want us to buy their products, which they certainly do, we're certainly still a major market for them, they have to start reinvesting in America. They have to start treating their employees with respect.
Jack in Kent, Washington, listening to Talk 1090 in Seattle. Jack, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, hi, Bernie Sanders. Glad to meet you. I'm over the phone, of course. Bernie, I got a question. About 6 months ago, I sent a letter to our Governor Gregoire. It ties into WPA and CCC during the Depression.
Yep.
And I said, I want you to have every mayor in the city, in the state, of every small town, in every big city, give you a list of things they want done in their town or city. Send that list to the federal government, and get back money, like whatever millions you can get from the government. Then put those monies back into the small towns and the cities to create jobs for these young kids who are out of work.
Jack, I think you're exactly right. And I think the process you have described is a good process. It's going to be the mayors of the small towns, the city councils, governors of states who know what their infrastructure needs are. I think that's exactly what we should be doing. There's a group called the
National Society of Civil Engineers. And these are the guys who analyze our infrastructure. And that's just roads, bridges, water systems. We have water systems in the state of Vermont that were built before the Civil War, leaking like crazy, wasting all kinds of water. You got wastewater plants, which are not doing their job. You got old schools. You got airports in this country. You got a rail system, which is falling further and further behind much of the rest of the world. We got an energy system, which needs to be transformed. And I think Jack's point is exactly right. The federal government has got to start investing in these projects. We put millions of people to work, not just blue-collar workers. You got architects. You got engineers. You have people who are producing the products that we're going to be using to rebuild the infrastructure. There is an enormous amount of work to be done, and I think Jack has got it exactly right.
Ed, in Erie, Pennsylvania, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello.
Hi.
Senator Sanders, I was wondering if you could introduce a bill in the Senate that would allow patents after, say, 15 or 20 years, the people haven't acted on these patents, the patent would expire, and it would be published so that anyone out here in the country could go and work on it. There was a gentleman who had a patent to get 100 miles a gallon out of a carburetor. He vaporized the fuel in a tank and then ran it through his air conditioning compressor, pumped it back into the carburetor, and because it was now a gas instead of a liquid fuel, he was getting 100 miles to a gallon out of it. And, of course, Shell bought the patent from him and did nothing with it. And I think that, you know, if you introduce it in the Senate and we all started hitting our congressmen with it, you know, we want them to follow up on it, perhaps we could find something that we the people could do to not just get more mileage per gallon, but
right.
But on all these different patents.
Okay, and let me just say this. What you're talking about is extremely important. And I think the issue here, and it is an issue that we are working on. I'll give you an example of where we're working on it. It's a little bit different than what you're talking about. The issue that Ed is talking about is sometimes you have these patents, and they last forever. And what Ed's talking about, if they're not being used, why can't somebody jump in and utilize it? But the other issue here, I'll give you another example of that, Ed, is in prescription drugs. Right now, the United States government, and amazing, this is one of the good things, few good things that George Bush did. He paid attention internationally to the AIDS crisis. And the United States government played a significant role in helping poor countries in Africa and elsewhere address their AIDS crisis. Let's pick this up after the break.
Sure. We'll finish that thought right after this. It's 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line. Check out his website at sanders.senate.gov.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
And over at Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov, you can find the Bernie Buzz, Bernie's newsletter. You can sign up for his amendment to roll back Citizens United. Welcome back, Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. And Bernie, for our commercial radio listeners, could you just very quickly, 20, 30 seconds, recap about the AIDS drugs? You mentioned that just before
we got a question on intellectual property rights. The United States government now spends a significant sum of money buying AIDS drugs to help people in the developing world, Africa and elsewhere. The cocktail that is generally used costs the United States government somewhere around $200 to purchase.
Per year.
Per year to treat people. That same cocktail in the United States of America costs the state of Vermont or the state of California, every other state, or any individual, over $20,000. Because here you're buying it as a brand product, and when the United States purchases it for overseas, you're getting it at a generic price made in India or someplace.
It's amazing.
Same product, $200 treating an AIDS patient in Africa, over $20,000 treating that patient here in the United States.
Yeah. Marie in Las Vegas, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Marie.
Hi, Senator Sanders, thank you for taking the time and talk with me. I would like to mention why the corporation doesn't pay the workers. It's because they believe in Austrian School of Economics and Reaganomics, also known like Friedman Economics. And those economics, they don't believe that the workers are the ones who create the wealth. They believe that the wealth is created from the marketplace, and that's why everything belongs to them. And whatever they give to the workers is just what the workers earn on the market. And it's not, there is no way we can fight with them without government help or union organizing. There is no other way, because they just don't look at us like someone who actually make their fortune.
I think Marie makes an excellent point. I think you know, in Congress, what we hear a lot of from our Republican friends are giving tax breaks and everything we can for the so-called job creators. Meanwhile, the needs of working people are dismissed. It's harder and harder for workers to form unions. It's harder and harder for millions of working people to survive on the wages that they earn. So I think Marie makes an excellent point.
Al in Buffalo, New York, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, good afternoon, Tom, and good afternoon, Senator.
Thank you.
What is the best way to use the media, Senator? Because I don't think, with all due respect, sir, I think you're preaching to the choir here.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as getting the message out to CNN, number one enabler, as far as, you know, not telling the truth, they enable the Republicans, okay? Now, we can't have another levee fall apart like the one in New Orleans, which basically turned the city into a bowl of soup. Another bridge collapsing on a busy day like the one in Minnesota. Senator, I am so mad right now. I am so angry with the fact that we have been so complacent with not being able to hold a press conference, just like the Republicans did. They held one after another, after another, after another. Why is it that guys like you, the truth tellers, and Steny Hoyer, and some of the other strong progressives like Barbara Boxer can't get out there and hold a press conference every single day? We'll call this bill the National Emergency Infrastructure Bill. Turn it into an emergency. Force it down their throats. I've had enough. Thank you.
All right. You know, yeah. Al makes a good point. The only thing that I would tell Al, you know, I think his point is basically right. I think the Democrats and maybe myself should be more aggressive on these issues. But I would tell you, Al, if you're in Washington, D.C. every day, as I am, you'd be amazed at how many press conferences are being held. But sometimes they just don't get into your living room through your TV. But I think in terms of infrastructure, in terms of the transportation bill, Barbara Boxer is the chair of the committee. She's done an excellent job in trying to come up with a bill which would create a whole lot of jobs in this country. We're running into real opposition from Republicans. I know she has been aggressive, but I think your point is well taken. Maybe we have to put the emergency element into it, because we do have bridges that are going to collapse. And I think more importantly, we have millions of people who desperately need work, and rebuilding our infrastructure is an important way to address the unemployment crisis.
Ray in Vero Beach, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Bernie. I've contributed to your cause a couple of times already, and you know I live in Florida.
Thank you.
I worked for 23 years in Manhattan advertising agencies. In 1968, at Pepper Canyon and Lois, as an all-media planner buyer, I was offered an opportunity to hand over a guy's account, working on a senator's account, Senator Jake Javits. I presume you've heard of Jake.
Yes,
2 weeks later, the same fellow came down the hall and said, we have a new account, and that's Bobby Kennedy. Well, have any probably working on a Democrat and a Republican? And I said, no, that's fine. That's great. So for the next few months, I had on the left side of my desk, Jake Javits, and on the right side, Bobby Kennedy. Now, I've been following politics ever since, and I've worked on another number of campaigns, some of them presidential.
Ray, we have just 1 minute till the end of this hour.
Okay.
Quick question for Bernie.
These people are 100% of a party in the United States Congress, took an oath to support the Constitution of the United States. They take the same oath that every draftee
every enlistee.
Is your question, why are they pledging to Norquist instead?
Exactly.
Okay, let Bernie have the last 30 seconds here on that.
Well, I think, Ray raises a very, very interesting issue, is that you have a lot of right-wing Republicans who have taken a pledge to Grover Norquist that they are never going to raise taxes on the wealthiest people in this country, and they're never going to raise taxes on the largest, most profitable corporations in this country. But what they are planning to do is to cut Social Security or end Social Security as we know it, end Medicare, end Medicaid. And I think what we have got to, but the voters of this country have got to tell those senators and congresspeople that their allegiance is to the people of this country and not to Grover Norquist.
Amen. Senator Bernie Sanders, Bernie, thanks so much again for being with us this week.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
And every week, all these years. Be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Today, by the way, is the 42nd, if I'm doing my math right, anniversary of the May 4th, 1970 shooting at Kent State. And, I think one of the, who raised this question here? Let's see. It was Davos, I believe. No. It was Sildley. I'm probably mispronouncing that. My apologies. In our chat room. Asks the question, will a militarized police force facing Occupy Wall Street lead to another Kent State massacre? Today is the 42nd anniversary. And this is the 42nd anniversary. Kent State was a horrible, horrible moment, an episode in this nation's history. And I personally think that the militarization of our police departments increases the probability of something like that. You know, so far it's just been pepper spray and tasers and tear gas bombs, but who knows where this is going to lead. So that, it concerns me tremendously. Anything Goes Friday, 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, and Mike in Fairfax, Virginia. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I have a question, and, you know, I think a lot of people hear words and they don't understand the underlying meaning, but they get repulsed by the word. You know, when Alan West said there were 70 or 80 communists in the House, I think he was referring to the Progressive Caucus. And
he said he was.
What's that?
He said he was.
Yes. I guess my question is, how does the Progressive Caucus's modern American progressive agenda differ from what Karl Marx called the 10 pillars of communism? When I look at them, they look very similar.
Well, I have no idea what the 10 pillars of communism are. I don't pretend to be a scholar of communism, but I do know that the core concept of communism is that there is no private property, is that the state owns all property, and nobody in the Progressive Caucus is proposing that. Nobody.
No, I understand, but when I hear this rhetoric about the 1%, it's the property doesn't belong to them. They got it corruptly. They got it illegally, so the government's entitled to redistribute that. But when I look at
you're missing the point entirely. It's not that, I mean, some people got it in ways that were corrupt, and the corruption that they principally did was buying off legislators to pass laws. But the vast majority of the people in the 1% and the 1/10 of 1%, the 1/100 of 1% got their money legally. And, you know, you can argue that the laws shouldn't have been written that way, but they got their money legally. It's not a question of corruption. It's a question of what kind of society do you want to live in? Do you want to live in a society where you know, you've got 50 million people who don't have access to health care? Do you want to live in a society where you've got 20 million children who at some point in their life are going to go to sleep hungry?
I understand, and those are things that we can all come to some agreement on how to work. But I think that I recommend you Google the 10 pillars of communism, because it's government.
Oh, I read them decades ago.
They're guaranteed the right for the workers to control the means of production. It's all of that kind
this,
of stuff.
This would not be something that Karl Marx wrote because he didn't write in that style. I have in the last decade read the Communist Manifesto by Marx and Engels, and I know that that's not in there. It's been 30 years since I read Das Kapital. It was probably, you know, the Ten Pillars of Capital. Who knows who wrote it? It was probably some right-wing PR flack trying to say, here's what the liberals think and here's what the... But the fact of the matter is that communism failed. Communism doesn't work. In fact, even the Chinese communists are no longer practicing communism. They're practicing, by and large, state-run capitalism, state-owned capitalism. They're practicing it very well and very aggressively. And
I think it scares people. When I May Day, I was down in Washington, D.C., seeing some of the protesters. Yeah. There were an awful lot of hammer and sickle type signs, and if that's part of the Occupy movement, I think that scares more people than it does any good. I think a lot of people carrying those signs just don't understand what that means either.
In particular, the 19 and 21-year-olds carrying those signs don't understand what it means to the 50 and 60-year-olds and 70-year-olds who remember the Soviet Union. Sure, I agree with you. Just like I think that a lot of the people who show up at Tea Party events carrying signs that portray, you know, President Obama with a Hitler mustache or far more offensive things than that, probably don't realize the damage that they're doing to the Tea Party movement. But the fact of the matter is that any movement is going to have an entire spectrum of people, and you can't condemn an entire movement because of that.
Can I make one other quick observation?
Please.
I think the difference between libertarians and progressives is less than people think. I think that
no, it's huge.
When I talk to them, they believe that it's the corporations corrupting the government, and they want the controls on the corporation side of that. Most of the libertarians I talk to think it's the government that they elected that sold them out, and they want controls on the government to prevent them and take back control. I think both.
No, but they don't. Libertarians don't want control. This is the point. Libertarians don't want control of the government because they want the government to be so small that it's not in need of control. That is the position of libertarianism is that if you let the economy drive things, there's no need for government. And the fundamental mistake that libertarians make is failing to understand that there's a difference between an economy and governance. That government and governance are what we the people collectively do about the critical things that have exclusively to do with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, or largely life and liberty, that we the people do to maintain those things and make sure that those things exist. On the other hand, what markets do is they exist principally to make money. And government doesn't exist to make money. And libertarians think that if you let a market, which only exists to make money, basically make all the decisions for the country, somehow that's going to be the best for the country. And it has never worked ever in the history of the human, in the 7,000-year history of civilization. Libertarianism has been tried many times. It has never succeeded. It always devolves into either anarchy or oligarchy. Give me one example of one country or one state or even one city where libertarian principles have been put into place and have succeeded, and I'll spend the next 10 minutes apologizing to you.
Well, I can't give you a country-level example, but, you know, I think there are plenty of competitive things where the price has gone down. I look at certain types of...
That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about where the government does nothing more than run the police department and the courts, which is the libertarian practice, or the libertarian policy. That's all we should do. Police department, army, and courts. That's it.
Well, but first of all, I hear people use police and fire and teachers. I pay local taxes and property taxes and county taxes and state taxes for that. I don't feel like if I live in Virginia, I should be paying for the Nancy Pelosi Park or the Frank Murtha Park in Pennsylvania. I think that local revenue and state revenue is generated to create that local social safety net. I don't expect the federal government to pay for
that.
Well,
then what you're advocating is that those people who have the good fortune of being members of the Lucky Sperm Club and being born into relatively affluent areas, you know, their neighborhood is paying a lot of taxes, making a lot of money. They get their parks, they've got a nice public, you know, but those people who are not members of the Lucky Sperm Club and get born into an inner city or get born into Appalachia, they should not have a public park. They should not have, public lands. They should,
but,
you know,
but
and that's
that
not,
is,
that's fundamentally not consistent with American principles.
There's 50 states, and if you've got two states competing for residents and revenue and tax dollars and businesses and jobs, then some states are going to do things that promote good behavior and they will be successful. And other ones, it's beautiful to let the states experiment and try different things. The problem at the federal level is when it's a one-shoe-fits-all, it ends up being the lowest common denominator for all 50 states. And regardless of which, whether it's progressive or libertarian, 50% of the population's pissed off.
Not exactly. And that's Mike, there's some truth to what you're saying. And that's why Social Security is not enough to live on. It's enough to keep you out of poverty. That's why most federal programs are not designed to be the whole thing. They're the minimum safety net. They're the thing for the most fragile. They're the thing to catch the people who are going to fall through the cracks if they're born in those really poor areas, and or if they're not born into wealthy families. And I think it's important that progressives and conservatives agree on this principle that should be the case. Anyhow, Mike, thanks for the call. And thanks for listening to SiriusXM Radio. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Anything Goes Friday. You pick the topic. Well, I've got a few I want to rant about, too, but we will get to those as we go on through the day.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows anything goes.
Anything Goes Friday, Tom Hartman here with you, and welcome back. There's a lot going on in the world, and let me just give you just a quick recap of a couple of things here, and then we'll pick, your phone calls for the rest of the day. Unemployment rate dropped 0.1% in April. The economy added 115,000 jobs, and this is despite the fact that in 25 states, Republicans have actually cut state spending. They're doing everything they can to crash the economy, and still. In fact, there was a piece in the New York Times this morning. I was reading it this morning about how Europe chose to go the austerity route, which is basically what the Republicans are pushing, and they're crashing and burning. And the United States, under both George Bush and Barack Obama, decided to go the route of stimulating the economy. The Fed, the stimulus bill, Bush's initial bailout of the banks, which I think was handled wrongly, but it at least stopped a certain amount of hemorrhaging, that the United States is doing well and Europe is crashing. It should tell us something, because the Republicans all want us to do what Spain is doing and what Italy is doing and what Ireland is doing. And the Democrats want us to do what Sweden is doing and what Norway is doing and what, Scandinavia countries are doing. They're doing very well, thank you very much. They're growing. They're strong. Canada never had any bank failures, not even a hiccup. Canada's banks are just fine, thank you very much, as is their economy by and large. Why? Because they heavily regulate their banksters. Their banksters are not billionaires in Canada. They're just, normal wealthy people. They're not the Romney-style rich. And then, meanwhile, there's this thing called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is coming out, this trade agreement. 84, as I recall, Democrats and one Republican, 68 House Democrats and one Republican sent a letter to the president of concern about this, because this treaties supersede the law of the land. If the United States signs a treaty with another country that says that every time you hear Frank Sinatra saying you've got to throw a pizza in the air, then that becomes the law, right? And or whatever it may be. And there is this law on the books called the Buy American Act that was passed in 1935 that says that the federal government has to buy from American sources first before it can buy from foreign sources. It can only buy things made foreign if this is just federal spending, but that's like 20% of the economy. It can only buy foreign stuff if there's no domestic source or if there's a waiver. Now, Reagan started the process of just granting waivers willy-nilly, and it has continued through every presidency since then. But this Trans-Pacific Partnership specifically blows up the Buy America Act. And so there's a number of people that, basically the Progressive Caucus is concerned about this. And you might want to let your member of Congress know if you have that, if you share that same concern. So, tensions flaring between Russia and the West on Thursday. Russia's top military commander warned that, he had Reagan's Star Wars thing, and then George W. Bush said, okay, we're going to do Star Wars right on the Russian border. Now, can you imagine if the Russians put a missile installation in Toronto or on the Mexican border? I mean, they tried to put a couple of missiles 90 miles away in Cuba. We freaked out. But right on the border? Well, that's what George W. Bush was doing to Russia and or proposed doing. And it's still, it's got momentum. It's still going. And NATO is talking about doing this. And the Russians are freaked out about it. And this is not a good thing. To restart the Cold War. So one of the Russian defense ministers, top military commander, said, they would not rule out preemptive military strikes against the NATO missile sites. They're not talking about nuking New York. They're talking about taking out the missile sites that are presumably going to be in Poland and putting in their own missile sites in Kaliningrad. I've been in Kaliningrad. It's a beautiful old city. It used to be called Königsberg when the Germans owned it. It's gone back and forth between the Germans and Russians, the same way Alsace-Lorraine has gone back and forth between the French and the Russian and the Germans, But in any case, this is not a good thing, and we need to wake up to this. Anyhow, Stephen in Burbank, California. Let's get back to your calls. Anything goes Friday here. Stephen, thanks for listening to Sirius. What's up?
Well, Tom, what's happening is I was going to talk to Bernie about perspective, about what constitutes a definition of a job or employment or productivity. When you see people punching the time clock and making stuff that is built to break through planned obsolescence, when we see oil being dug out of the ground, turned into plastics, the plastics are being thrown into the dumpster, into the landfill, into the Pacific Ocean. When we see all this waste, when we see all this destruction, we have to look at what constitutes a job, what constitutes a boondoggle. And we just keep going around in this circle. You know, I got to punch the time clock, got to get the money to pay the rent. And what you're doing is being destructive. I was at L.A. County Hospital just the other day. My friends Sanchez and Sherelle dragged me in there from May 1st activities at Pershing Square. And they stayed with me all night long. And when they asked me what my job is or do you work, I said, no, I don't work. I punch the time clock. I burn 50 to 60 gallons of gasoline a week taking built-to-break car parts to be installed in built-to-break cars to burn fossil fuels. Now, that is not being productive. That is being destructive.
Well, and this is why we need a national policy for green energy.
Well, that too, and also,
it's pretty straightforward stuff, right?
Yeah, well, you had another car.
Raise the tax on carbon.
Yeah, this is funny because I've been calling around and yammering about how I am a Zen Marxist, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's okay because Andrei Gribachich accused Noam Chomsky of being a libertarian communist. And then we have another guy saying this guy was an anarchist who thought he was a communist.
Right. A Zen Marxist. I love it. Stephen, thanks for the call. Thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. A Zen Marxist. I don't think Karl Marx would be real happy with that, you know? But you never know. We'll be right back. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
By the way, you can sign up for our podcasts, our free video stream, you can participate in our blogs, our message boards, and join a chat room all over TomHartman.com. Yep, today, the 42nd anniversary of the Kent State Massacre. Let us hope that cycle does not repeat itself. Doug in Springfield, Missouri. Hey, Doug, what's up?
Hey, I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
Listen, I'm on the road a lot. I listen to a lot of different stations from the left and from the right. And I'm just really, the other day I heard you mention, and I may be saying it inappropriately, but the Lucky Sperm Donors or the Lucky Sperm.
Lucky Sperm Club.
Yeah, there we go. And, you know, I'm a middle-aged white male that grew up, in the inner city, grew up in poverty, didn't have anything given to me, scratched and clawed, didn't have anybody to support me for college education, and I've been able to, build a business and do fairly well. And I feel like we kind of get left out here because I'm not a Mitt Romney. I don't make, hundreds of millions of dollars. I work hard every day. I get insulted sometimes when I guess based on my economic position, I'm no longer, the working class. And from my perspective, everybody talks about it being fair, but you know, I do believe I do contribute my fair share.
Do you make more than $1 million a year, Doug?
I make near that, yeah.
$1 million a year?
Yeah.
How much is that a week?
I don't really know, to be honest with you.
Okay. What was your last paycheck?
Let's just say last year I made about $920,000. So.
Well, how much was your last? What did it say on your last paycheck? How much did you make?
Well, I it's a corporation, so I take dividends. So I don't pull the money unless I need the money. So most of the money goes to investments. And
you can't take dividends out of a wholly an individually owned corporation.
You can take it in an S corporation. I can't take dividends.
But they're taxed just as ordinary income. That's the whole point of an S corporation.
That is correct. So I'm paying taxes on it.
What you do is you write yourself a paycheck and you have to make deductions. So I'm just curious, what do you do that's worth, you know, $100,000 a month?
I am a consultant. I go into businesses and negotiate contracts for health benefits for organizations.
Mm-hmm. So you're working in the healthcare industry.
I am.
Wow, that's sad. So what was your question again, Doug?
Well, why is that sad, though?
Well, I think it's sad that we have the business of what should be the business of keeping people well that is generating, $1 million for a guy like you, when the doctor who is checking out the throat of the 10-year-old girl down the street here is probably making $150,000, $200,000, maybe $300,000 a year in a really, really good year in a big city. And it just seems to me bizarre. It doesn't happen in any other country. There's no other country in the world where somebody who's a consultant in the healthcare business can make $1 million a year.
Well, and that's what I love about this country is that you can, by virtue of your efforts and seizing opportunities,
become a predator.
Have the opportunity to go out there and do that.
Anybody in America can become a predator.
Well, I disagree with you. What I actually do is save my clients' money. Quite frankly, I'm more of a consumer advocate than I am an insurance advocate. I'm not a Republican. I'm an independent.
I'm not attributing partisan politics to this. Your question, I'm still not sure what your question was to me. And the reason I asked if you make more than $1 million was because the Buffett rule doesn't kick in until after your million and first dollar. So if you made about $900,000 last year and you make the exact same amount this year, President Obama doesn't want to raise your taxes. Now, I do. I think that, I I'll tell you why. Because during times, and Larry Beinart has done the very best job of writing about this, but this is no secret. I mean, you just look at the history of the United States or any other country. In those countries and during those times, when the tax rates on people who are earning over roughly, in today's dollars, $1 million a year, are above 50%, then that money becomes dear, right? That money becomes important. Now, first of all, what it means is your first time, your first $50,000, your first $20,000, you're paying no taxes on at all. Your next $50,000, you're paying 8 or 10%. Your next 30, beyond. So it increments up, first of all. So you're not really paying 50%. You wouldn't be paying 50% on all of that $900,000. It would only be on maybe from $500,000 up in my world, right? The way that I think that it should be. But the point is that, or on the million and up, and Obama wants it to be 30%. I don't think that's enough. First of all, working people, if you're taking pay out of a sub S and you're making that kind of money, you're paying 36%. So I think, you should be paying 36% right across the board. And everybody should. But the point is that in economies where over $1 million incomes are taxed above the 50% level, you do not have boom and bust cycles. And in economies where you have tax rates below the 50% level, you do have boom and bust cycles. And the reason why is real simple psychology. And that is that once you start making over $1 million a year, you are not, any money, any additional money that you get is not money that you need to live on. In fact, arguably after a couple hundred thousand, or even, depending on your lifestyle, but it would take a bizarre lifestyle to say, I need that second million to live on, right? And so because it's not money that is dear, it's not money that is needed, it becomes money with which people can gamble, and they do. And that gambling leads to these boom and bust cycles. It's hot money in the economy. And that's why from 1935 until 1985, 1986, basically, when Reagan dropped the top tax rate down below that 50% threshold, we did not have any boom and bust cycles in the United States. For the first time in the history of the United States, we had never gone from the George Washington administration until the FDR administration. We had never gone more than 15 years without a major bank failure or a major market panic in the United States. Never more than 15 years. And we went, 50 years? Something like that. I can't do the math in my head that fast. But from 1935, basically 34, 35, when those taxes, when the taxes rates were raised by FDR up to 91%, and they stood there through the Roosevelt administration, the Truman administration, the Republican Eisenhower administration, the Kennedy administration. Johnson dropped them down to 74%, but they were still above 50%. They stayed there during the Nixon administration. Nixon thought that was good and fair. No boom and bust, right? The Carter administration, and then finally Reagan comes along and he drops it down to 28%. And within a year of the time that he dropped it down, the S&L collapse happens, and the largest stock market crash since 1929 happened. And that's why, it's just common sense economics. I don't begrudge you your income. Doug, tell me I'm wrong.
Well, I think we just disagree. I mean, from your perspective, and I understand you're much more diverse in your knowledge of the history of economics.
I'm saying look it up. You can Google it. Just Google.
Oh, sure. No, I don't disbelieve you. I guess my position is I wanted to get call you really just to get some feedback. I try to engage in conversation with people who have this belief system. I'm interested and want to gain knowledge.
I am not. Let me just be really clear here. I think that this is practical stuff that I'm talking about, Doug. And I'm not opposed to people making a lot of money. And in fact, I think it's a fine thing if people, particularly if they have the skills. I think that doctor should be making good money. But my point is that I'm not an ideological Marxist. I'm not saying, from each according to his right. Ability, to each according to his needs. That works fine in societies where everybody knows everybody. It works fine in a kibbutz. It works fine in a small community, 150 people or fewer. But once you get into a large nation, it no longer works. And so communism only works in small, very, very small organizations, as was demonstrated by the large organizations of the USSR and others. And so I'm just pragmatic. I'm trying to figure out what works. And if you look at the history of the United States, we only had in the 230-plus year history of this country, we have only had, in all the history of this country, we've only had 3 consecutive decades, 30 straight years, where GDP growth was above 3% and where the middle class steadily grew. And that was the time, that was the 1950s, the 1960s, and the 1970s. That was the time when the top tax rate was 91%.
Well, I know is that when everybody talks about, people making a certain amount of money, and in fact, you use the word predator. I'm in an industry where I'm a predator.
Your industry is predatory.
Well, my industry, though, is...
But the healthcare...
I'm not in the insurance industry. I'm not in the healthcare business. I'm in the consulting. I help the consumer.
Okay.
In fact, you talk about wellness plans and things like that. Our job is to try to get the rates from the insurance companies down. I'm an advocate of the consumer.
For your...
negotiate contracts for...
presumably for your corporate customers. No, I understand.
But I just get to the point where I get frustrated because, I'm open to help and to do whatever I can do for the society. But on the other hand, I get tired of being, called.
Don't you think, Doug, that it's a little weird that you can make $1 million a year as a consultant, basically helping people work around for-profit health insurance companies, and the doctor who's actually curing cancer? The doctor, the surgeon who worked on Louise last week, my wife, who had breast cancer, that he's probably making less than half of that, maybe a third of that. Don't you think there's something weird about that?
I think there's something broken with the system. I'm absolutely.
Well, then we have achieved a moment of a singularity, a moment of agreement. Doug, I'm sorry we're out of time. Thank you very much for the call. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything Goes Friday. Bring it on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service, find out what's going on in the world, and more of your calls and my pontifications here on Anything Goes Friday. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Oh, and let me just remind people, if I may, Victoria, before you start, I don't have it with me, but tonight in Portland, do you know the name of the theater, Victoria?
Don't know the name of the theater.
Okay. I'm going to track that down and plug it again here in the next little bit. It's the Hollywood Theater. Okay, thank you, Jacob. Thank you, Louise. At the Hollywood Theater, Ellen Ratner is going to be doing a fundraiser and a general thing. It's going to be hosted by Carl Wolfson, dear friend and the morning host at KPOJ, AM 620 KPOJ in Portland. And she's going to be showing the movie about her and her life and her it's not just about Ellen, but it's a pretty amazing movie and about our trip to Sudan and all kinds of cool stuff. So A Force of Nature is the title of the movie. So check that out. Victoria, what's going on in the world?
Plenty, plenty today.
I see you're in the basement of the White House.
I'm in the basement today. Yes, indeed. The president spoke at a rally at Washington Lee High School in Northern Virginia today and really went house after House Republicans for passing legislation that would stop the interest rate hike on federally subsidized student loans by eliminating a fund from the health care reform law. And he basically said that Republicans were responsible for the deficit. He said the country went to two wars without paying for it, he told the students, and gave two tax cuts to people who didn't ask for it and don't need it. And he also said he didn't think it was fair when they suggest students like you should pay more to help bring down the deficit when Republicans spent the last decade running up the deficit. And he said, and they want you to pay an extra $1,000 a year for college. It doesn't make sense.
I agree. Did the students agree?
Well, I think they were quite loud.
Yeah, okay.
They were quite loud and quite jolly. Now, this, of course, is going to come up again next week, I should think, when Congress comes back. And Republicans have been hammering away at this. They hammered away at it this week and went after the health law Wednesday for expanding the preventative care grant. And they claim that it has funded pet spaying and neutering in Tennessee. Don't know if you heard about that.
That's no, I hadn't.
It's one of the claims they made.
I'm sure it's at the top of Drudge, but actually, you know, pet spaying and pet neutering is a fairly worthwhile thing to sponsor.
That's what I thought. Well, anyway, it turns out, I did some research into this because it got my attention. It turns out that the Tennessee official whose job includes directing a federally funded anti-obesity program in Nashville, mm-hmm, under the Prevention Fund, says there was a spay and neuter clinic, but it was funded by a PetSmart Charities grant to the Nashville Humane Association.
So the one guy does two jobs, and one of his jobs is spaying and neutering pets, which is funded by PetSmart with a grant, and the other job is administering some of the health care money. What the Obamacare, what does this fund do?
Well, the preventive care fund.
Oh, this is the preventative care fund.
Prevent
things like obesity.
The Energy and Commerce Republicans pointed to two documents on recovery.gov, and they saw spay and neuter clinics, and rather than doing any research, they jumped to the conclusion that it meant that spaying and neutering had gone on.
And then it goes viral, and suddenly every right-wing talk show host in America is talking about it, and it's a lie.
And so now it's become reality when, in fact, it never happened.
Amazing.
Amazing. TransCanada reapplied for the Keystone Pipeline permit today.
Yes, we were anticipating this. This is going to be a tough one for the Obama administration.
It is. The State Department issued a statement saying that the application included new routes. It didn't identify them. Said it would examine whether the project is in the national interest. It said the determination process involves consideration of many factors, including energy security, health, environmental, cultural, economic, and foreign policy concerns. Said it would probably be complete by April 2013. That will not please Republicans who want this done before the election.
Oh, that's great. 2013. Yes. So is Obama going to be able to hold to that schedule and say, you know, we'll talk about this after the election?
This is going to be fascinating because this is going to come up because state is going to be accused of being in the bag for Obama on this.
Well, what a surprise. State works for Obama.
There you go.
I mean, you know, this is a presidential prerogative, and every president of both parties has used it forever.
There you go. So that is definitely going to come up next week. I'm sure you've talked about the unemployment numbers, so I'll mention them briefly before I go to my catnip Friday story.
Okay.
The U.S. only added 150,000 jobs in April, actually about 130,000 private sector jobs, but of course of net losses in the public sector brought it down to 150,000.
Scott Walker laid off a few more people.
Indeed, mostly teachers and
teaching-related
jobs. Unemployment rate is 8.1%, mostly through people ceasing to look for work. They do have some hope that lowering of gas prices might bring about an increase in jobs in the next month or so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And your catnip story?
The Heartland Institute, a conservative think tank that disputes climate science, has a new PR strategy in Chicago with billboards that associate belief in global warming with the Unabomber and Charles Manson. I still believe in global warming, do you? Which features a photo of Ted Kaczynski. They've got other billboards with Charles Manson and Fidel Castro, and they have plans for Osama bin Laden.
Osama bin Laden believes.
And James Lee, who took hostages at the Discovery Channel 2 years ago.
So it's like, you know, any, I'll bet all those people also believe in gravity.
Right. The point is that believing in global warming is not mainstream, smart, or sophisticated.
That's absolutely bizarre. It's like, you know, the study that was touted some years ago that 100% of mass murderers have drank milk in their lives.
That's great.
And over 95% of them have eaten mashed potatoes.
That's great.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. And Carol in Minnesota, listening on AM 950. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You know, your last caller, I think, was a plant. And I know you're pretty aware of that.
I don't think he was a plant. I think he was exaggerating his income. It's why I asked him how much he made in his last month's paycheck. Because if you're making that kind of money, you know what your checks, you know, how much your check was. And he didn't. So, I think that he was exaggerating. But he didn't have the super sophisticated Republican talking points down. So I don't think he was a plant. I think he was just exaggerating.
Well, maybe he was a Tea Partier then. I Googled while I was waiting the 10 tenants, and it's, I mean, the first place I found it was the Blaze.
There you go.
And they had translated it. But at any rate, the one thing that really bothers me is this meme that says that somebody wants to take something away from you and give it to somebody else. And that is not what fairness, tax fairness, or progressive taxation is about. It's not about... It's a progressive taxation system is about not doing that. A regressive taxation is about transfer of wealth.
Right, from the bottom
up. We've had regressive taxation in this country since Reagan.
Right.
And that is exactly what has happened, is a huge transfer of wealth. A progressive taxation system doesn't hurt anybody. And you are right. It is what made this had this country a 50-year period where we didn't have any booms or busts.
And we had incredible prosperity, and we had three consecutive decades of 3.1%+ GDP growth, and we had an entire generation that you know, college attendance went from single digits to low double digits as a result of the GI Bill. You had African Americans who broke into the middle class as a result of the war on poverty and the Civil Rights Act. I think the next group that is going to be doing that is Hispanic Americans.
I've got to get the Republican brain, because I really can't understand. I grew up in a country where it wasn't how much money you made that was that determined your value. Mm-hmm. What determined your value was, were you a good school teacher? Were you a good barber? Were you a good police officer? Were you a good judge? Whatever your occupation was, were you good at it? And if you were good at it, your pay didn't come into it. Now it's like there are all these people that think that what is your value is how much you make. And I truly believe that people that make a lot of money do not understand people who work for the love of something.
To some extent, I think that's true. I think, though, I can tell you, I know some people who make a lot of money. And there have been times in my life when I've made a lot of money doing stuff that I really love doing. So I don't think that it's all or nothing. But there are some crazies out there who are just trying to get the money. I've always thought that if you do what you really love and you do it really, really well, you can make money at it. But that's not the point. And I think that the really important point that you made and that I'd like to amplify, Louise and I were walking over toward the metro. We take the subway to work every day, yesterday morning. And we were talking about, you know, when I was a kid growing up, and it was the milkman. You know, actually, our conversation started with, you know, how, you know, Monsanto and RGBH and, you know, is this contributing to disease in the United States, specifically cancers and things. Nobody knows for sure, but a lot of countries won't have it. And then you know, our conversation kind of evolved. And then it was like, hey, do you remember when the milkman used to bring dairy products to your house? You know, then it's like, and I knew a milkman. I mean, there was a milkman who lived in my neighborhood. Now, my neighborhood was kind of a lower middle class, you know, neighborhood. About half the people who lived in my neighborhood worked in there was a school teacher who lived down the street from me. My dad worked in a tool and die shop. I'd say probably half my friends, their fathers worked at General Motors, you know, for Oldsmobile, the Oldsmobile factory in town, or one of the companies that fed it. And there was a milkman. And you could make a living driving a milk truck around delivering milk. And you could raise your family. And the reason why is because the taxes on, you know, after you've made about $1 million in today's dollars, what back then would have been maybe $300,000, after you made that, the tax rate went up to 91%. And so the CEOs and the owners of the company said, well, you know, let's just pay our workers decently and not have turnover. Pardon me?
And that's exactly what I mean. You described where you lived, and I had a much more fluid childhood than you did. But the place that I most call home was my grandmother's, and next door to her house was a church. My grandfather was an engineer on the railroad. The guy that lived next door was a judge. The guy who lived next door to him was a conductor on the engineer. Next door to that was a school teacher.
Yep.
Across the street, the barber.
Yep.
There were a couple
and these
of
were-
guys who.
These were all middle class jobs.
Yes.
Yeah, and the house that, you know, the house that my dad that I grew up in and that my dad died in. I mean, you know, he bought, it was paid off when he died. He bought in 1955, as I recall, for $13,000.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it was a three bedroom, one bathroom house, and he and my mom had four boys, and we turned the bedroom in the basement into a second bedroom, which was mostly mine, and I shared with one of my brothers for a while. But, you know, we didn't think of ourselves as poor or deprived or anything. I mean, we just thought this is, you know, and Anyhow, Carol, we need to let the board is full. I want to get some more callers in here. Thank you very much for your call, and thanks for your kind words.
And thank you for what you do every day.
My pleasure. It is an honor to be here serving you and having fun doing this is you know, doing what you love doing. And Mark in Soap Lake, Washington. Hey, Mark. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up, Mark? No, Mark. Okay. Taya in Blackfoot, Iowa. Hey, Taya, what's up? We're no Taya either. Are you sure the phones are potted up? They are. Okay. All right. You got to be sure to listen. These were both Free Speech TV viewers. You got to be sure to listen to your phone, not your TV, because if you're watching television, there's about a minute delay. If you're listening on the radio, it's about a 9-second delay. Because it takes a while for the signals to get sent through the magic satellites and all this stuff. Chris in San Diego, California. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, how are you doing, Tom?
Great. Thanks for watching Free Speech
TV. Yesterday, there was an Army document that was leaked, and Russia Today covered it. I believe you work with Russia Today.
I don't. I do a program which is licensed by Russia Today, RT, actually. It's no longer called Russia Today, but yeah.
Yeah. The document is called Internment and Resettlement Program.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look over this, this is basically a re-education program for Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street activists.
Yeah.
And I encourage everyone to look at it.
Okay.
It was leaked by info.publicintelligence.net. This is something that's really scary, and this should be something that a lot of people should be looking at.
I guarantee you, Chris, it's just the tip of the iceberg. The police agencies around this country and the intelligence agencies, they are so on top of the Occupy movement, and just as they were the SDS, it's what governments do. And, the lesson from that is demonstrate peacefully. Don't be an idiot. If somebody comes along and says, hey, let's blow up a bridge, I got some C4 here, the FBI did to these five guys in Toledo or Cleveland or wherever it was in Ohio, you know, the arrest last week, don't be an idiot and say, oh, that sounds like a great idea. Bruce in Seattle. Hey, Bruce, what's on your mind? Oh,
anything goes, Fred.
Bruce,
I got
to put you on hold. I'm sorry. I blew right through the queue. I missed it. So, Bruce, let me put you on hold. We'll pick up your call when we come back from the break. 15 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Anything Goes Friday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Anything Goes Friday. Check out, drop into our free live chat room over at TomHartman.com and hang out with some of the finest minds on earth. I'm not making this up. Anything goes. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on Anything Goes Friday. Phil, listening on our iPhone app in Maryland. How do you pronounce your town there, Phil?
Well.
Say it again?
LaVale, L-A-V-A-L-E, LaVale.
Oh, LaVale, okay. So what's up? What's on your mind?
Hey, I appreciate everything you do, and thank you for being an honest person. My question is, if the Republicans were to get their way and give in to all this corporate influence and destroy the middle class, what do they think the end game is going to be? What's the ultimate goal?
Stability. They've been quite explicit about this. I encourage you, and everybody should, go back and read 1951 or 52. Russell Kirk, who is the godfather of the modern political movement, wrote a book called The Conservative Mind. And the first chapter of it is about Sir Edmund Burke, who Burkean economics. Burke was the guy who was around at the time of the American Revolution, who Thomas Paine got in such a spitting match with. He spent 2 weeks at Burke's home in the UK on his way to France to go be part of the French Revolution, that he wrote, Thomas Paine wrote an entire book in rebuttal to Burke, the book being The Rights of Man. And what Russell Kirk lays out in The Conservative Mind, and what was later endorsed, and you can easily find this, by people like William F. Buckley and Barry Goldwater, and now in modern times, the real conservatives, is that conservatives believe that society should be stable, that stability is the most or if not the most, certainly one of the most important values. And that a society that is going through a lot of change and transformation is a crisis. That is not a good thing. And so, you know, try to keep things the way they are. Try to keep things stable. And the best way to have a stable society is to have an absolutely all-powerful, autocratic, relatively small ruling class that controls the wealth and the political power, and to have a also similarly small middle class that facilitates trade. In other words, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, you know, the retail folks and the doctors and lawyers, and then to have a very, very large class of the working poor who, the rabble, who always are the ones who foment problems in society, and have them be sufficiently poor that they don't have the means to rouse the rabble, right? To be rabble rousers. And they
to me,
can,
that means that makes them almost corporate indentured servants.
Exactly. Exactly. When Burke was proposing his conservatism in the 1780s, you know, just after the American Revolution, at that time when Sir Edmund Burke was talking about the conservative mind. And as I said, this is the entire first chapter of Russell Kirk's 1951 or 52 book that was the inspiration for William F. Buckley and Barry Goldwater and you know, Mitch McConnell and the whole bunch. At that time, there were maximum wage laws in the United Kingdom. It was illegal to pay somebody over, you know, $2 an hour or whatever it was. And the reason why they had maximum wage laws, it wasn't to stop the rich from getting too rich. It was to stop the working poor from becoming the middle class. And you know, this was the time that Charles Dickens wrote about and that most Americans know from A Christmas Carol. And Scrooge was not the rich. Scrooge was the middle class. He was a small shop owner. He owned a small business. He had one employee. And you know, he had one employee in him. That was the middle class. And Bob Cratchit was the working poor, and that was the vast majority of everybody. And the true rich don't even show up in A Christmas Carol and Dickens' story, because that, of course, was the, you know, the lords and ladies and the king and the members of parliament and the landed gentry. So that's the world that Edmund Burke thought was good and stable, and that's the world that conservatives now want to take us to. So in answer to your question, that's what they want, stability. And in fact, Phil, thank you for the call. And in fact, back in 51, when Burke wrote this, it's really interesting to read some of the commentaries from the 50s and 60s. And I'm old enough to remember some of this stuff. that people were saying back in the 50s and 60s that, and my dad was saying, if this middle class gets bigger and bigger and bigger, then you're going to start seeing social instability. You're going to see African Americans demanding rights. Now, my dad wasn't saying this. He was not a bigot. In fact, if anything, he was the opposite. But there were people who were saying, you're going to see African Americans demanding rights. You're going to see gays demanding rights. You're going to see women demanding rights. You're going to see a society go through a wrenching change. And the conservatives of that era, the 50s and 60s, as soon as the late 60s happened, as soon as SDS and smoking pot and Timothy Leary and the women's movement and the Stonewall riots and the whole thing, when all that happened, they said, "See, I told you so. This middle class, it's dangerous for America. There's too many people who have too much money," and by too much money they meant $30,000-$40,000 bucks a year. Too many people who are just kind of making it, and you know, we just can't have that. So, anyhow, Jim in Las Vegas. Jim, we have just a minute to the break. I'll give it to you, and I'll riff on the way back.
All right, real quick. The Republicans, I heard they want to start another war in Iraq. Don't they realize that they can only do so much degradation to the earth? And you know,
no, they don't realize that. Yeah, first of all, you mean Iran, not Iraq, but I'm assuming.
Yeah.
No, they don't realize that. They don't think of this as degradation. There's this bizarre blindness, and I would point out to you, you know, if you'll look back at the Bush administration, the one guy who was arguing strongly against going into Iraq was Colin Powell, the one guy who had been on the battlefield and seen people die. And most of these guys who are these gung-ho Republicans who want to have a war with Iran and, you know, bomb, 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 bomb Iran and all this kind of stuff have never been to war. Now, John McCain is the exception, I suppose. I think he's just a little dotty in his whatever. Most of them are the chicken hawks. They're the people like, George W. Bush who got in the Champagne Unit, or Dick Cheney who got his 5 deferments, or all of the whole long list of neocons who signed the Project for New American Century, virtually none of whom served when they had an opportunity to during Vietnam. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. Anything Goes Friday. Check out TomHartman.com. We've got a new iPad and iPhone app as well. It's free.
Thank God it's
exposing the con and conservatives. Speaking of which, I love talking about it, Sir Edmund Burke. Edmund Burke's most famous quote, and I'm paraphrasing this from memory, and it's a probably a decade old memory, so I'm sure that this isn't word for word, but it's awful damn close. His most famous quote was, "It does me no harm if a man is allowed to engage in a profession as servile as that of tallow maker or hairdresser, tallow maker, candle maker, or hairdresser. However, it does society considerable violence if such a person is allowed to participate in governance." And by that, he meant vote or run for public office. That's the conservative viewpoint. David in Chicago. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to make a more contemporary referral to your discussion between Thomas Paine and Edmund Burke, namely Thomas Frank's book, The Wrecking Crew.
Oh, yeah.
If you recall reading that book, he masterfully sets it up so that when you get to Chapter 9, The Bantustan That Roars, then you understand exactly what their tactic is. And basically, they want to take this Mariana indentured labor model and bring that to the United States. And we know this is the intent of the elites because of what Alan Greenspan said in 2007 during his book tour, when he said he wanted to attract a very substantial quantity of skilled labor, which would suppress the wage levels of the skilled, because we skilled are being essentially subsidized by government, meaning our competition is being kept outside the country.
Right.
So I recommend that book, and then you'll get an idea of what their model is for the entire United States after trying this little experiment with Tom DeLay and Abramoff lobbying for the Marianas indentured foreign scab labor scam in the Marianas.
Very, very, very well said. David, thank you very much for sharing that. And you're absolutely right. And, in fact, I did a fascinating half-hour interview with Thomas Frank, who wrote The Wrecking Crew. And you can see it over at conversationswithgreatminds.com if you're interested. Bill in Laurel, Montana. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Well, Tom, I just want that young man right there just about elaborate what I was after. I just wanted you to elaborate, like, what model is Sir Edmund Burke referring to anywhere in society where that worked? I mean, how do you squash freedoms and liberties once they've been given?
Well, that's the question. See, Europe was stable. We call it the Dark Ages, from the end of the Roman Empire around 300 or 400 A.D. up until the beginning of the Renaissance in the 1400s, Europe was very, very stable during that period of time. There were not a lot of wars. There was not a lot of activity. There was not, not much happened. And the reason why was because it was basically all under the thumb of either warlords or popes. And there was a very small, very powerful ruling elite. There was a very small middle class that facilitated trade and commerce. And everybody else was a serf. It was a period of time referred to as feudalism, F-E-U-D-A-L-I-S-M. And that's the model that existed up until the late 1400s, the early 1500s. Then, Gutenberg's printing press, and after the Black Plague cut the population of Europe, which drove the cost of labor up dramatically. A third of Europe died. And so all of a sudden a middle class emerged, even though nobody wanted it. Because the Masons were the first, the stonemasons. They said, "Okay, there's a shortage of us, so we're not going to work unless you pay us well, right?" And that led to the Renaissance. People had leisure time, so they could do music, they could do art. And then the Renaissance, in turn, 100 years later, led to the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment really started, you could argue it was kicked off with Leviathan, the book by Thomas Hobbes, in which he talked about the natural state of man, you know, is nasty, short, and brutish, and all that kind of thing. But he also said that man should be capable of governing himself, and which was a heretical idea. And then 40 years later after that, more or less, this timeline is, you know, pretty rough off the top of my head, but in the mid-1600s, that would have been around 1634, I think, around 1660, 1670, and you just, you know, you lived by province of the king. And then he was followed about 20 years later by Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who in the 1680s, 1690s, as I recall, by that time, now the voyages to North America, they were bringing back all these Native Americans as curiosities and as slaves and looking at them. They were bringing people up from Africa, and the Europeans were discovering that these people were not, in fact, savages, and they were not, in fact, stupid. They came from very sophisticated civilizations that lived in peace. And so, you know, Rousseau took it even a step farther and said, you know, no, the natural state of man is not for life to be short, nasty, and brutish. The natural state of life is good. And thus, Hobbes established the first conservative worldview. Burke established the first liberal worldview. And then, you know, from there, the debate began. And that's, and probably one of the most brilliant of all the writers of the Enlightenment was Thomas Jefferson. And you know, with the Declaration of Independence and all of his other writings, and I encourage you to read as much of it as you can. But the point is that once that genie was out of the bottle, once the idea that you know, I mean, it used to be before the mid-1500s, if you learned to read and you were not a priest, you were put to death. If, you know, yeah. And so, but once that genie was out of the bottle, how do you put it back in? Well, that's what the British were trying to do with the maximum wage laws. They were trying to maintain that feudalism, but do it in a modern context. And as the Industrial Revolution came along, it became harder and harder and harder to do. And now, you know, which brings us to the Arab Spring and I think the American Spring and whatnot. And I see this, you know, this arc bend, you know, to badly paraphrase Martin Luther King, bending toward justice, bending toward enlightenment, bending toward liberality, to use George Washington's phrase. He said, "I hope I shall ever see America a more liberal nation." I see that happening, and it actually encourages me. But that model for the original conservative model of super stability was feudalism, and then of course it became, you know, Burke's notion of how wonderful England was, and you know, when you know, A Christmas Carol was being written by Charles Dickens, and the reason why Charles Dickens wrote about Puck and about, you know, all of the various books that he wrote was because his own father had spent a year or two in debtor's prison. So Charles Dickens really knew how this system worked, and he fillets it. I mean, he lays it out in his writings. Although most people today don't read Dickens, they're at least familiar with the story of The Christmas Carol. Bill, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. Bruce in Seattle. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
Not much, Tom. I've got a quick question for you. I can't wait to see your movie Heist. Have you watched the Frontline documentary called Money, Power, and Wall Street by any chance? It's a two-part series.
No, I have not. I frankly have very little time to watch television these days. I don't think I probably watch more than 3 or 4 hours a week of it. So
it's a very good.
It's worthwhile, huh?
Two-part.
Okay.
Yeah, and watch that. And you know, I know you don't give investment advice, but I did a little investing myself back in the day. I'm kind of, you know, like you, stay away from the stock market. But something I haven't heard lately, I don't know if you heard it or not. Have you ever heard anybody use the rule of 72 lately? I haven't heard that lately.
The rule of 72? No.
You remember they say you're supposed to invest your money and every 7.2 years it's supposed to double?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right. They don't use it anymore when they try to get you to invest anymore. So, and
That's because inflation hasn't been stable and the market hasn't been stable. I mean, you know, back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, when the market was stable and inflation was relatively predictable. I mean, it did bite us in the late 70s as a result of the war debt from the Vietnam War. But up until that time, you could fairly, you know, you could invest safely and modestly.
Yeah, it doesn't apply anymore. And this Money, Power, and Wall Street documentary, they were showing these people who had these advanced math degrees, and they actually went to work for Wall Street, and there were three ladies that were there, and they were watching the people down on Occupy Wall Street and the 99%ers, and they were kind of shaking their heads, and then they realized what they were doing was absolutely wrong. And they actually went down and joined them. It's so corrupt. And like you say, it's not about them being a service industry anymore. It's about them making money for themselves and kicking the can down the road so when it all blows up, somebody can say, okay, I worked there 10 years. I got out. You know, I made all these umpteen million dollars, and there's a mess. There's no social conscience whatsoever on Wall Street, and we've got to enforce the doggone laws that we have on the books. They're on the books, but it's not being enforced.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why in the heck we got rid of Glass-Steagall. I can't figure that one out for the life of me.
Well, that one, you know, kind of got slipped by. I wasn't super politically aware at that point in time, and I wasn't paying attention when it happened, so all I have to rely on are the old news reports and things. But basically, the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act was promoted as a reform. It was it was either 99 or 2000. It was during the Clinton bubble. I mean, things were going really well, and I don't mean that in a total negative sense. The dot-com bubble would probably be a better way to describe it. And it just seemed like, you know, nobody could do anything wrong, and technology was where it was at, and the banks are becoming technological, and they're all becoming computerized, and so, you know, let's get out of the age of green eyeshades and fountain pens and let banks move into the era of computers and whatnot. And what people really didn't know was that Phil Gramm's wife was on the, you know, on the board of Enron, and this was, you know, it was Phil, Ken Lay, who wanted Enron to be able to engage in banking activities so that they could self-finance their scams. And Phil Gramm was a front man for Enron, basically. But people, you know, I don't think most people realized that at the time. Bruce, thanks a lot for the call, and I'll have to look for that documentary. It's 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
26 straight months of job growth. Now, in Europe, where they're doing austerity, not so much.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, our associate producer, Jacob Dean, our video director, Jim Javinsky, our phone screener, Paul Edney, our writer-researcher, Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum of WYD, all the various companies that syndicate our program, Dow Global on commercial stations, Pacifica Radio on nonprofit stations across the nation, Free Speech TV on Dish Network and DirecTV, and all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, all the others around the country, to Don Rojas, Dennis Trudnov, all the other great folks, Don Rojas, I'm constantly mispronouncing Don's name, all the other great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on the big picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Sincerely. So, Virginia?
In Portland. KPOJ.
Okay.
Listen, everybody's been wondering for months who's the real Mitt Romney, since he said everything on every possible issue, and I finally figured it out.
Okay.
Now, I think the story about Seamus is telling, but the most telling story is his wife, Anne, who has multiple sclerosis.
Right.
And if you know someone with multiple sclerosis, you know it's a terrible, debilitating, insidious condition, which is aggravated by fatigue and stress. That fact notwithstanding, this man is so self-absorbed and so ambitious, he's dragging her around on a campaign bus to make him look good.
Well, maybe. I have to say...
Maybe.
Here's why I'm saying maybe.
Sweetheart, Tom.
Some people love their work. I mean, you don't know. It may be that Ann Romney is who made Mitt.
I can tell you that, and the reason I'm saying this is I'm just looking at my own life. I would not be where I am had I not married Louise 38 years ago.
Yeah,
and
Louise
and she's
now had MS or had some terrible disease.
Well, Louise had breast cancer, and she had
dragging her around the country.
And Louise has breast cancer, and she had surgery 2 weeks ago, and she's answering the phones today, not because I asked her to. I'm saying, why don't you stay home and relax? And she's like, are you nuts? I love my work.
Yeah.
And so she's here because she wants to be here, and I mean genuinely. And so I'm not ready to judge a married couple.
Who chose to stay home.
Pardon?
All these years, and now all of a sudden she's not home because her husband wants to be president.
Well, it may be we don't. I'm really reluctant to judge the heart of another person. And
I knew you would disagree with me.
See, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying I don't know. And it may well be that Anne is the force behind Mitt. So very few people that I've known who are genuinely successful got there all by themselves. Most of them got there with the help of a partner, you know, somebody who supported them. Now, sometimes it was a business partner. Sometimes
I get that, but it's supposed to go both ways, Tom.
I agree, but I don't know enough about MS to speak to that. You may be totally right.
It's so awful. It's awful.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Virginia,
I have friends who've had it who killed themselves. It's so awful.
Oh my. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Virginia, thank you for your call, and we'll see. Time will tell. I suspect, you know, these things shake out. Jim, here in Washington, D.C., listening on We Act Radio, 1480 WPWC, here in D.C. What's up, Jim?
Hartman, how you doing, buddy?
Say what?
I said, hello, Mr. Hartman, how you doing, buddy?
Oh, I am doing great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Well, I'm surviving. Well, I do one day at a time. That's all I can do.
Anyway,
get to the point. It's pretty obvious that some cuts and changes need to be made to the U.S. Postal Service. Heard you champion behind all the workers. In your opinion...
Wait a minute. Why you say it's very obvious that cuts need to be made? Are you familiar with the legislation in 2006 that took the post office from being profitable and on the verge of moving over to an entire fleet of electric cars to being in the hole?
Well, I don't think that's where they dropped the bomb. They should have seen,
so you don't know about the postal reform legislation 2006 that the Republicans pushed through and that George Bush signed, the poison pill. Let me inform you about this, Jim, if I may, for just a minute. This law says that over the next 10 years, the post office has to fully fund the retirement benefits of every person who will work for the post office, assuming current levels of employment, for the next 75 years. Now, that means somebody who's hired 75 years from now, it has to fund their retirement, right? So we're talking about over a 10-year period, the post office has to set aside $5 billion a year and put it into a fund, which is already over $40 billion, to pay for the retirement of employees who have not yet been born. In fact, to pay for the retirement of the children of employees who have not yet, you know, who are going to work for the post office. The only reason this was done was to throw the post office into a crisis because the post office in 2006 was showing a surplus. It was profitable. They were talking about converting many of their vehicles into solar power, into electric powered cars and being at the forefront of a solar change in America. And the Republicans just wanted to put an end to that, all that talk, throw the post office into a crisis. And oh, by the way, have I mentioned that the post office is the single largest unionized employer in the United States? 500,000 employees is the second largest employer in the United States behind Walmart. Walmart is not unionized. And so the conservatives looked at this and said, oh, a union with 500,000 people? We would love to bust that union. And so they passed this law, and that's why they're trying to take down the post office. It's got nothing to do with the post office needs to be cut. If anything, I think the post office should be expanded. When I lived in Germany, I could go to the post office and deposit checks. I could go to the post office and wire money. There's all kinds of cool stuff that you could be doing at the post office right now. Should be able to do. We should be able to register to vote at the post office. We should be able to vote at the post office. We should be able to get our driver's license. There's lots of good stuff that the post office could be doing. So they don't just have to do mail. Anyhow, thanks so much for being with us. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there and get active tag. You're it. We'll see you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.